A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. So, Hannah sent us a prompt this week that feels like the perfect crescendo to our deep dive into Micheline Duclef's book, Hunt, Gather, Parent. We have already looked at the Maya in Mexico and the Inuit in the Arctic, but now we are heading to Tanzania to look at the Hudza Bay. And specifically, Hannah and Daniel are looking for how these ancient hunter-gatherer principles apply to a 9-month-old like Ezra, who is currently in that beautiful, exhausting stage of crawling, cruising, and basically trying to taste the entire world.
Herman Poppleberry here, and I have been looking forward to this one because the Tanzania section of the book is arguably the most radical departure from modern Western parenting. When you look at the Hadza Bay, you are looking at a culture that has remained relatively unchanged for tens of thousands of years. They are one of the last true hunter-gatherer societies on Earth. And what Duclef finds there is a total rejection of the parenting as a project mindset that we see in the United States or Europe. By the way, today's episode is powered by Google Gemini 3 Flash, which is helping us synthesize these cross-cultural insights.
It is funny you mention parenting as a project, because that is exactly what it feels like when you have a 9-month-old. You feel like you are the chief entertainment officer. If the baby is awake, you have to be performing, right? You are shaking the rattle. You are doing the funny voices. You are narrating the laundry. It is physically and mentally draining. But the Hadza Bay approach seems to suggest that all that performance might actually be getting in the way.
It absolutely is. The fundamental shift in the Tanzanian model is moving from a child-centered universe to an adult-centered, integrated community. In a Western home, we often stop everything we are doing to play with the baby. In the Hadza Bay camp, the adults continue their work foraging, preparing tubers, fixing tools, and the children are simply integrated into that reality. They are not the center of attention, but they are never excluded. It is a state of constant low-intensity inclusion rather than high-intensity, intermittent entertainment.
But how does that look for a 9-month-old who can't forage yet? If Hannah is trying to answer emails, or Daniel is trying to fix something, and Ezra is pulling on their pant legs, the performance feels like the only way to keep him from screaming.
That's the entertainment trap. We've conditioned infants to expect a show. The Hadza Bay don't play with babies in the way we do. There is no peekaboo for 3 hours. Instead, the baby is strapped to someone's back or sitting on a lap while the adult talks to other adults. The baby is a witness to social life, not the director of it. For Ezra, this means he needs to learn to be a bystander to his parents' lives. If Daniel is fixing a shelf, Ezra is on the floor nearby with a safe tool, watching. No one is singing a song about the screwdriver. The screwdriver is just a screwdriver.
So it's less about what do I do with the baby, and more about how do I let the baby exist while I do what I need to do. That is a massive weight off the shoulders. But let's get into the first big pillar Duclef talks about, which is the alloparenting network, or what we usually call the village. In Tanzania, this isn't just a metaphor. It is a biological and social reality.
Right. The Hadza have this incredible social scaffolding. From the moment a baby is born, they are held by dozens of different people. It is not just mom and dad. It is siblings, aunts, uncles, and the elderly. There is a specific study mentioned where researchers tracked Hadza infants and found they were held by someone other than their mother for about half the day. And here is the kicker for the tech-minded listeners. This creates a massive reduction in the single point of failure, risk. If mom is tired or dad is hunting, the baby's needs are still met by the collective.
See, that sounds like a dream, but for a modern parent in a nuclear family setup, it feels impossible. We don't live in a camp. We live in houses with fences. But Hannah's prompt asks how to translate this for Ezra. If we don't have a tribe of 50 people outside the door, how do we mimic that circle of care?
It starts with breaking the psychological monopoly on the baby. Dockliff observes that Western parents often feel a sense of guilt or anxiety if someone else holds the baby and the baby whimpers. We rush in to save them, but the Hadzabe stay calm. They trust the network. For Ezra, translating this means intentionally expanding his social flexibility. It means letting a friend or a neighbor hold him, even if he is in that stranger danger phase, and staying back. If the adult stays calm, the baby eventually realizes that safety isn't a person. Safety is an environment.
I like that. Safety is an environment, not just a specific pair of arms. It reminds me of the social referencing mechanism. At 9 months, Ezra is constantly looking at Daniel or Hannah's faces to see how he should feel. If he is being held by a new person, and he looks at Mom, and Mom looks stressed and ready to pounce, Ezra thinks, oh, this is a crisis. But if Mom is across the room, calmly folding laundry and not even looking his way, he thinks, okay, I guess this person is fine.
Well, not exactly, but you've hit on the core mechanism. The Hadzabe practice what is called non-exclusive attention. They are aware of the baby, but they aren't staring at the baby. This reduces the pressure on the infant to perform or react. There is a great case study in the book about a Hadza toddler playing with a sharp digging stick. In a Western context, three adults would be screaming, "Be careful!" and diving for the stick. In the Hadza camp, the mother is nearby processing tubers. She sees the stick. She is anchored with the child, but she doesn't intervene unless there is an immediate lethal threat. This allows the child to develop self-regulation and physical literacy.
But wait, a digging stick is one thing, but what about the modern equivalents? If Ezra is cruising toward a glass coffee table or reaching for a heavy book on a shelf, do we just sit there? How do we balance minimal interference with my kid is about to get a concussion?
This is where environment design meets observation. The Hadzabe camp is relatively safe by design, not because it's padded, but because it's open. For Hannah and Daniel, it means creating a yes space. If the living room is a minefield of things Ezra can't touch, the parents are forced to be no machines. The Hadza model requires the parent to be a calm observer. You only intervene if the risk is high. If he bumps his head on a soft rug, you don't gasp. You stay calm. You are training his nervous system that a small bump isn't a catastrophe.
That "be careful" habit is so hard to break. I bet Daniel and Hannah say it 50 times a day. But if you think about it, "be careful" is a pretty useless command for a 9-month-old. They don't have the cognitive architecture to understand the physics of a fall or a sharp edge yet. All they hear is a high-pitched panic noise from their primary security source. It just spikes their cortisol without teaching them anything about the object.
And that leads us to the second pillar, radical autonomy, or the no-command zone. This blew my mind. Dukleff notes that the Hadzabe almost never give direct orders. No sit down, no eat your food, no don't touch that. They believe that children are born with an innate drive to be helpful and to survive. When you give a command, you trigger counter-will, the instinct to resist being controlled. By 9 months, that no phase is already starting to bud.
So if you aren't giving commands, how do you keep a mobile 9-month-old from, say, eating the dog's food or crawling into the dishwasher? Is it just total anarchy?
Not at all. It is about modeling and environment design. Instead of saying no, you use redirect and integrate. If Ezra is heading for the dog bowl, you don't bark a command. You might gently move the bowl or, more importantly, you model the behavior you want. The Hadzabe treat children as competent individuals to be integrated. If you want him to eat, you sit and eat with him. You don't hover over him with a spoon like he is a science experiment. You just live the life you want him to follow.
It is the apprenticeship model. We talked about this a bit with the Maya, but in Tanzania, it seems even more extreme because it is so nonverbal. They don't explain things. They don't do educational play. There are no colors and shapes, flashcards for Hadza infants. They learn by watching adults do real things.
And this is where the mirror neurons come in. At 9 months, Ezra's brain is basically a giant sponge for mimicry. When Daniel is cooking, the instinct is often to put Ezra in a playpen with some plastic toys so Daniel can get things done. The Tanzanian model suggests the opposite. Put Ezra on the floor in the kitchen, safely of course, and let him watch the cooking. Give him a wooden spoon and a metal pot. Not a toy pot, a real pot. He is observing the flow state of an adult doing a meaningful task. That is far more cognitively stimulating than a plastic toy that lights up and plays a synthesized song.
But what if the real thing is boring? We've all seen a baby play with a spatula for 2 minutes and then throw it. In the Hadza culture, do the children just sit there for hours while the parents work?
They don't just sit, they drift. They might watch for 10 minutes, then crawl to an auntie, then look at a bug, then come back. This is unstructured exploration. In the West, we panic if a baby isn't engaged with a specific activity. We think we have to keep them busy. The Hadza let the baby manage their own attention span. If Ezra gets bored of the spatula, he finds a shadow on the wall. That transition from one focus to the next is a critical brain development moment that we often interrupt by trying to show them a new toy.
I love the idea of the flow state. We often interrupt babies when they are focused. If Ezra is staring at a dust mote or trying to figure out how a hinge works, a well-meaning parent often walks up and says, "Oh, look at the shiny hinge. Good job." And boom, the concentration is broken. We have just trained the baby that their focus is secondary to our social interruption.
That is a huge point. Doklef calls it minimal interference. The Hadzabe value, quiet observation. When an infant is focused, the adults stay silent. They don't narrate. They don't praise. Praise, in this context, is actually seen as a form of control. If you praise good job, you are setting an external standard for the child's activity. The Hadzabe want the child to be internally motivated. If Ezra figures out how to stack 2 blocks, the reward is the fact that the blocks are stacked. He doesn't need a round of applause to know it worked.
This actually makes parenting easier, doesn't it? It takes the pressure off the parents to be constant cheerleaders. It is okay to just exist in the same room as your kid without being their personal circus performer. But let's talk about the harder stuff. The big feelings. 9-month-olds get frustrated. They want to reach something they can't, or they are tired but can't fall asleep. The Western instinct is to fix it immediately or to get stressed by the crying. What do the Hadzabe do?
They practice emotional equanimity. This is the third pillar. When a child has a tantrum or cries, the adults don't get hooked. They stay incredibly calm. They don't see the crying as a fire that needs to be put out with frantic energy. They see it as a passing wave. If the parent stays like a calm anchor, the child eventually learns that their emotions are manageable. If the parent gets frantic, the child thinks, "Oh no, even the big people are scared of my feelings. This must be a real disaster."
It is like that old saying, "Be the thermostat, not the thermometer. Don't reflect the baby's heat, set the temperature of the room." For Daniel and Hannah, this means when Ezra is whining because he can't quite crawl over a rug, they don't have to rush in and lift him. They can just sit there, maybe give a calm nod, and let him work through the frustration. That frustration is actually where the learning happens.
It is productive struggle. And at 9 months, everything is a struggle. Learning to move your body is hard work. If we remove every obstacle, we are essentially robbing them of the chance to build resilience. The Hadzabe model suggests that a 9-month-old is far more competent than we give them credit for. They are trainee humans, not helpless dolls.
But how do you reconcile that with the biological need for comfort? If Ezra is genuinely distressed, not just frustrated by a rug, but like teething pain or overtired, the Hadza don't just ignore that, do they?
Not at all. They are extremely responsive, but the ways they respond is different. In the West, when a baby cries, we often match their intensity. We go, "Oh no, what's wrong? It's okay," in a high-pitched voice. A Hadza adult will pick up the baby, but they do it with a neutral, calm face. They might hum or just hold them firmly while continuing their conversation with another adult. They provide the physical comfort without the emotional drama. They are essentially saying, "I hear you are upset, and I am here, but the world is still a safe, stable place."
So, let's translate this into some concrete, actionable strategies for Ezra right now. We have the allo-parenting, the no-command zone, the minimal interference, and the emotional equanimity. If Daniel and Hannah are looking at their schedule for tomorrow, how do they actually implement Tanzania mode?
Okay, let's start with the inclusion protocol. Instead of separating chore time from Ezra time, merge them. If you are folding laundry, put Ezra in the middle of the laundry pile. Let him feel the textures, let him pull the socks apart. He is helping by being present. You don't need to give him a toy version of laundry. The real stuff is better. This is what Dukeliff calls togetherness.
And then there is the boredom buffer. We're so afraid of our kids being bored. We have toy rotations and iPads and sensory bins. The Tanzanian model suggests that boredom is actually the threshold of creativity. If Ezra is bored, he will eventually find something to investigate. A shadow on the wall, the way his fingers move, the texture of the floor. By reducing the constant stream of novel toys, you encourage him to develop sustained attention.
Right. And I would add a village audit to that. Daniel and Hannah should look at their social circle and ask, who can be an anchors for Ezra besides us? Even if it is just a neighbor coming over for coffee, don't feel like you have to entertain the guest while Ezra is tucked away. Let the guest hold him while you do something else. Build that social flexibility. Now, before the separation anxiety of the toddler years really kicks in.
I also love the quiet observer challenge. Try to spend 20 minutes a day where you're in the same room as Ezra, but you don't speak to him or look him directly in the eye unless he initiates it. Just watch him. See what he chooses to do when he thinks no one is watching. It is fascinating to see a 9-month-old's internal logic play out when they aren't being directed.
What is wild is that research bears this out. We mentioned it briefly, but infants around this age show distinct cortisol spikes when they are separated from caregivers in sterile or strange environments. But in environments where there are multiple familiar figures, even if they aren't the primary caregivers, those stress markers are significantly lower. The village isn't just a nice social idea, it is a biological buffer against infant stress.
It really challenges the nuclear family ideal, doesn't it? We have built a world that is optimized for privacy and autonomy for adults, but it is actually quite maladaptive for raising humans. We are trying to do with two people what the Hatsabe do with 30. No wonder Daniel and Hannah are tired.
And that is the ultimate takeaway from the Tanzania section. The burden of the duo is a modern invention. By integrating Ezra into the adult world rather than building a separate child world for him, they can actually reclaim some of their own lives. He isn't a project to be managed. He is a new member of the team.
But wait, how does this work with safety in a city? The Hadza are in the bush, but Daniel and Hannah are in Jerusalem. There are cars, there are stairs, there are electrical outlets. You can't exactly have minimal interference with an electrical outlet.
This is where physical boundaries replace verbal commands. In a Hadza camp, the fire is the center of life. The kids learn about the fire by being near it, but the adults might place a log or a barrier in the way of a crawling infant. For Ezra, the modern equivalent is baby-proofing. If you don't want him to touch the outlets, cover them. If you don't want him on the stairs, gate them. The goal is to make the physical environment do the parenting, so the adults don't have to keep saying, nah. Once the environment is safe, the parent can truly practice minimal interference.
That makes so much sense. You're delegating the discipline to the architecture of the house. It takes the conflict out of the relationship. Instead of Ezra seeing Hannah as the person who always stops his fun, he just sees a gate. The gate isn't mean, the gate is just... there.
Precisely. And it allows the child to develop environmental awareness. They learn the limits of the physical world rather than the limits of their parents' patience. That is a much more stable foundation for a developing mind.
The Hatsabe don't view children as projects to be managed, but as competent individuals to be integrated into the group. That quote from the book really says it all. It is a shift from parenting as a verb to living as a family.
It is about moving from what do I do with the baby to how do I live my life with the baby alongside me. It sounds subtle, but for a 9-month-old, it is the difference between being a spectator and being a participant.
Well, I think that is a great place to wrap up our Tanzanian deep dive. Huge thanks to Hannah for the prompt. It is always great to hear from the other half of the Jerusalem headquarters. And of course, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the gears turning.
And a big thank you to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power the AI behind this show. Without them, we would just be two animals talking to a wall.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you're finding these parenting deep dives helpful, or if you just like hearing a sloth and a donkey talk about hunter-gatherers, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It really helps other people find the show.
We'll be back next time with whatever weirdness Daniel or Hannah sends our way. Until then, stay calm like a Hadza.
Or at least try not to say, be careful for 5 minutes. See ya.
See ya.
So, Herman, I was thinking about that minimal interference thing. Do you think that applies to our podcast? Like, should I stop interrupting your long-winded explanations to allow you to reach a flow state?
Nice try, Korn. But I think our village requires a bit more back and forth than a Hadza tuber processing session. Besides, your interferences are usually the only thing keeping the listeners awake.
True. I am basically Ezra's wooden spoon. Tangible, slightly disruptive, but ultimately part of the process.
Let's not get carried away with the analogies. We promised the listeners we would keep those to a minimum.
Right. One per episode. I'll save the next one for when we talk about quantum entanglement or something equally sloth-brain-friendly.
I'm looking forward to it. But seriously, the Tanzanian model, it's about trust. Trusting the baby, trusting the community, and trusting yourself to stay calm.
Trust is hard when there is a 9-month-old heading face first toward a coffee table. But I guess that is where the environment design comes in. Make the room a yes space, so you don't have to be a no person.
Precisely. Well, not precisely, but you've got the spirit of it.
You almost said the forbidden word, Herman. I saw your donkey ears twitch.
I would never. My commitment to substantive dialogue is ironclad.
We'll see how long that lasts when we get into the next section of the book. Anyway, let's get out of here before I start narrating my own exit. Korn is now reaching for the mute button. He is pressing it. Good job, Korn.
Stop. Just stop.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Actually, Herman, before we go, we should probably mention that for anyone who missed the first two parts of this series, we did a whole episode on the Maya and the Helpfulness Principle, and another one on the Inuit and Emotional Control.
Good point. It really is a team framework. Togetherness, encouragement, autonomy, and minimal interference. We've covered the T, the E, and now the A and the M.
It is like a puzzle coming together. And Ezra is the lucky kid who gets to be the guinea pig for all this ancient wisdom.
He's going to be the most integrated 9-month-old in Jerusalem.
Or the one most likely to try and forage for tubers in the backyard. Either way, it's a win.
Definitely. All right, now we are really leaving.
Peace out.
Take care.
Wait, one more thing.
Korn.
I'm kidding. Just testing your emotional equanimity. You passed, mostly.
I'm a donkey, Korn. We are known for our stubbornness and our calm, mostly.
Mostly. All right, for real this time. End of episode.
End of episode.
Whispering. Good job, Herman.
Sister of all goods.
Okay, but seriously, let's talk about the alloparenting thing one more time, because I think it's the part people struggle with the most in modern cities. Daniel and Hannah are in Jerusalem, which actually has a bit more of a community feel than, say, downtown Manhattan, but it's still not a Hadza camp.
Right, and the research shows that alloparenting isn't just about having people physically present, it's about the quality of the trust. In the Hadzabe culture, there's no parental gatekeeping. In the West, we often have this idea that only mom knows how to soothe him, or only dad knows his specific cry.
Gatekeeping is a great word for it. It's like we build a moat around the baby and then wonder why we feel isolated. If you tell everyone you're doing it wrong, eventually they stop trying to help.
And at 9 months, the baby picks up on that gatekeeping. If Ezra sees Hannah constantly correcting Daniel, or Daniel correcting a babysitter, Ezra learns that there is only one correct way to be cared for. That makes him less resilient. The Tanzanian model suggests that having 5 different people soothe you in 5 slightly different ways actually makes you more adaptable.
It's like cross-training for the soul. You learn that the world has different textures and different rhythms, but you're still safe in all of them.
And that adaptability is a massive evolutionary advantage. If you look at the history of our species, we didn't survive because we were the strongest or the fastest. We survived because we were the most socially flexible. We could cooperate in large, fluid groups.
You know, I was reading a side note in the research about how Hadza grandmothers are actually the secret weapon of the tribe. They provide more calories to the group than almost anyone else by digging for tubers. It's called the grandmother hypothesis.
It suggests that humans evolved long lifespans specifically so that older generations could help raise the young. It's built into our DNA to have multiple generations involved. When we try to do it with just two parents, we are fighting against millions of years of evolution.
So, the takeaway for Hannah and Daniel is, call the grandparents. Often. And when they come over, don't give them a list of instructions. Just hand over Ezra and go take a nap.
That is the most Hadza thing you could possibly do. Trust the elders. They've seen 1,000 Ezras. They know what they're doing.
So, by letting the village in, Daniel and Hannah aren't just getting a break. They're actually giving Ezra a masterclass in being human.
I mean, yes. That is exactly the point.
You said it. You said the word.
I did not. I said yes.
I heard an E-X-A-C-T-L-Y in there, Herman. The donkey is slipping.
We are moving on. We are moving on right now.
Laughing. All right. Let's wrap this up before the AI realizes we're just stalling for time.
The AI knows everything, Korn. It's Google Gemini 3 Flash. It's already 3 steps ahead of us.
Fair enough. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We'll catch you on the next one.
Unless I get integrated into a group of sloths and decide to stay there.
We should be so lucky.
Hey!
Little bye-bye, Korn.
Bye, Herman Poppleberry.
Clearance.
Silence. Okay, now it's awkward.
Just push the button, Korn.
Pushing it now. 3, 2, 1. Sound of a click. Wait, did it work? Just kidding. Bye.
One last thought, though, before the signal truly cuts. We talked about non-exclusive attention, but we should clarify that this doesn't mean ignoring the baby. It's a high-awareness, low-intensity state.
Like a lifeguard, they aren't splashing in the water with you, but they definitely know where you are.
That is a perfect analogy. A lifeguard doesn't narrate your swimming. They don't say, "Look at you kicking your legs, good job." They just ensure the environment is safe for you to swim. That is the goal for Ezra's parents. Be the lifeguard, not the swim coach.
I like that. Less coaching, more guarding. All right, now I'm really pushing the button.
For real this time?
For real.
Good.
So, Herman, think about this. If we are lifeguards, what is the waters in Ezra's scenario? Is it just the living room floor, or is it the whole social experience he's soaking in?
It's both. The water is his entire sensory world. If the water is turbulent, meaning the parents are stressed, loud, or overly controlling, the swimmer struggles. If the water is calm and predictable, the swimmer can focus on their own technique. At 9 months, his technique is learning how to manipulate objects and navigate social cues.
And if the lifeguard is constantly blowing the whistle for every tiny splash, the swimmer gets nervous and stops trying new strokes.
Precisely. You want him to feel the buoyancy of his own competence.
Buoyancy of competence. I'm writing that down. That's a keeper.
I'm glad you approve. Now, can we please conclude?
Yes, boss. Lifeguard Korn, signing off.
And Lifeguard Herman, heading for a very quiet stable.
See ya.
Goodbye.
Click. This episode was produced using Google Gemini 3 Flash. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my wee.